Hello, this is Dr. Shiva. Welcome to our podcast, Get Educated or Be Enslaved.
Episode 1508, air date October 29th, 2024.
All right, everyone, welcome. This is Dr. Shiva Iyaduri. We're going to be having a very interesting meeting or discussion with Sean Baker and myself on a bunch of topics, but it's really a get to know each other for both of our audience. But we thought we'd talk about the carnivore diet, grass-fed versus grain-fed. They may be similar, they may be no issues, but we thought we'd do that, Sean.
And, hey, I'm happy for that. That sounds good. Yeah, awesome.
But I thought maybe it would be good, Sean, is for our audience to sort of get a little background on you. What you've been doing, just, you know, quick blurb, and then I'll give a little bit of my background and then we'll sort of riff. Yeah.
So, I mean, my background, by training, I'm an orthopedic surgeon. I practiced conventional medical care for a couple of decades. And at some point I kind of got a little bit, I got interested in my own health, to be honest. I mean, that's where I really started on this. And I saw, you know, just by changing the food I was eating, basically, and I saw pretty significant improvements. And at that time, we had a lot of obese patients. Well, we still do. We always have a lot of obese patients. But, you know, they're sometimes challenging to operate on. You know, I mean, sometimes technically it's a little harder, but really it's they're at higher rates for complications. And we were trying to minimize that. And, you know, we as a collective community of orthopedic surgeons said, hey, we need to kind of deal with this obesity stuff. You know, try to get your patients to lose weight prior to bringing them to surgery. So we would just kind of collectively do it so people would actually be forced to lose weight. And, you know, there was no guidance. It was like, we were kind of left up to our own devices. And so at that time I was pursuing kind of a lower carb ketogenic diet, and I started to apply that to my patients that would actually do it. And then what really struck me as interesting is, you know, I mean, some of them would lose weight, some of them wouldn't, but almost most of them would come back reporting that their knee pain was significantly lessened or almost completely eliminated. And so at that point I was saying, well, if you don't have pain and you can stick with this diet, then there's really not a need for the surgery. And I thought that was quite good. You know, of course, medicine being what it is, hospitals being what it is, they didn't like the idea of me canceling surgeries. They were kind of frustrated because that's how they pay the bills, right? So anyway, that's where I started. And then I kind of went down this rabbit hole of nutrition. And I really dug into it for many, many years. And then,
what year was that, Sean?
This is like 2013 or something like that, 2012, 2013. Oh, okay.
This is only recently, relatively.
Yeah, so this is 12 years ago or something like that. And yeah. And then I persisted with that for several years. I ran into a group of people that were eating all meat, and I thought they were completely nuts. I thought these people are completely nuts, right? Like everybody does, like the people think I am, right? But they had a compelling story, and I kind of followed along kind of vicariously watching them. And I had this morbid curiosity. And then one day somewhere in the middle of 2016, I decided to try it myself, and I did it for like a day. I was like, oh, you know, I didn't die or anything. And then I dragged it out. Eventually towards the end of 2016, I did it for a month. I was on what was Twitter at the time. I know we know each other on X now, but I was on Twitter and I said, hey guys, I'm going to do this 1 month. I'm only going to eat meat. I know I'm going to die. What am I going to die of? Am I going to get scurvy? Is my heart going to clog up? You know, is my colon going to fall out from lack of fiber? I kind of did it as a joke. But you know, I did it seriously. And at the end of the 30 days, I didn't die. Obviously I'm still here. And I actually felt fantastic. I was like, this is literally, and I was just about to turn 50 at the time. So I'm about 58.
And so Sean, you just ate meat, no vegetables, no starch, nothing.
Right. I think that month it was either just meat or might've been meat and eggs. I can't remember. You know, it's been
no
a while.
Butter? Did you include butter?
I might've cooked with it. I might've cooked with it. I mean, it was a lot of like, you know, fat with the meat. And of course,
yeah,
cause you gotta have energy from some source. And I literally, I mean, it was like something, you know, I mean, I remember one thing that struck me as really interesting is because, you know, I'm an orthopedic surgeon. I deal with musculoskeletal aches and pains all day, every day. I kind of know what we know about what you do about that. And I had this persistent quadriceps tendon pain. It'd been bothering me for 10 years. I remember I'd injured it squatting, you know, years ago, squatting like 500 pounds and put a little pull. I think I had a partial tear there, but it had bothered me. I mean, literally every week, a week didn't go by where I didn't have some pain, and it was limiting. You know, it wasn't severe, but it was enough to where it would inhibit me from doing a lot of things I like to do. And within the end of the month, I had noted that pain had basically gone, and I've been trying to get rid of it for 10 years. I've been doing all the exercise and all the stretches and anti-inflammatories and all the stuff that you would do for this typically, never made much of a difference. And then it totally went away, and it's still gone. But to this day, you know, 8 years later, it's still gone. So I just thought that was curiously interesting. And so, you know, I kind of sort of had an epiphany, and I became jaded at the same time, because the hospital system didn't want me to pursue this. They were like, not only did they not encourage me to do this, but they actively discouraged it. Because again, it impacts the bottom line. What are we paying you for? We're paying you to cut people open and throw joints in them and fix their ACLs and all that stuff and fix their fractures, which is great. That's what I was trained in. But at the same time, I was kind of like, well, most of my patients are here because of chronic poor lifestyle decisions and metabolic health issues, which manifest themselves as orthopedic issues, arthritis, tendonitis, compression neuropathies like carpal tunnel syndrome, all those things I was seeing. I was like, these things could be addressed just by changing their diet and lifestyle. Again, there's not a lot of money to be made now, unfortunately, but that's the truth. And so I kind of saw that there was a dead end with me being able to do that. So I ended up leaving clinical practice, you know, partnering with somebody who had, my partner, who's someone who was impacted dramatically by it. She had an autoimmune issue that went into complete remission. She happened to be very tech-minded, entrepreneurial-minded, and we kind of came together. And so we started, you know, working together. Eventually, we formed our current company called Rivero, which is basically, you know, we're licensed in all 50 states. We basically take people that have, you know, obesity, hypertension, diabetes, metabolic disease, autoimmune disease, inflammatory disease, and we treat them at the root cause. And we're having some really, you know, really tremendous success with this. So this is something that this is what I do today. I basically cheerlead this stuff, because I'm out there trying to get this message out there, because I think, you know, as you said, the healthcare system is woefully, it's problematic for sure. I mean, the incentives are, in my view, kind of perverse. It's been completely captured. It doesn't serve the patient's needs to the degree that it should. I mean, practicing, and I'm sure you're familiar, a lot of people like the sick care system, because it's basically, you know, I started, you know, my first entry into medicine was in the 80s. And I remember, you know, kind of, you know, doing the stuff, going through school, going through my training. Somewhere in there in the lexicon became this concept of disease management, which before what do you mean disease management? What does that mean? Right? We're not talking about cures anymore. We're talking about chronically medicating people for the rest of their life. And that became the sort of, you know, the encompassing philosophy or theory of medicine these days. And so it's just like, so now we just medicate everybody for the rest of their life. And you know, I don't know who's happy about that. I guess the patient's mildly happy. The folks profiting on that are probably quite happy. So that's what I do. I basically sit here and complain about how bad the healthcare system is, but I don't just complain. I'm trying to do something about it. You know, and I think that's the thing, you know, there's problems you identify, but then, you know, what's the solution, right? What's the solution here? And I think, you know, we need to re-incentivize how we treat chronic disease in particular. I mean, I think we do really good with acute care. I mean, I don't want to get anybody wrong. If I'm in a car wreck and my femur's sticking out of my thigh, don't feed me steak. I mean, you know, you know, take me to get me patched up. But I mean, when it comes to chronic disease, I mean, as you know, I know you're running for president. You got to know the healthcare statistics. I mean, $4.5 trillion every year on one of the least efficient medical systems in the country. I mean, we have some of the best tech, but at the same time, our results, you know, looking at life expectancy, chronic disease prevalence, how many diseases have we cured? None, basically, or very few, if any. So that's the background where we're coming from.
Yeah, Sean, I thought, you know, when I know that the reason I've seen a friend of mine is a does a carnivore diet strictly, you know, you know, I lift weights together. But he has got Paul Saladino. Mm-hmm. Paul.
Right.
It'd be interesting to find out, you know, what's the difference between what you do and he does.
Yeah. We can definitely delve into that if you want.
Very briefly, what I wanted to share was this is why, just everyone listening, I saw you put this tweet out. I pick? And you're up in Washington. It's one of the states that we got on the ballot. You know,
I was amazed at how many presidential candidates we have on the ballot in Washington. I didn't know all. You know, I'd heard of you before. I hadn't heard of, you know, I'd obviously heard of Trump and Kennedy and Harris, but you know, and I saw you down at the bottom there, and then it was kind of funny when you said, "Hey, let's go have a conversation." So I haven't filled out my ballot yet, so I'm still open, man.
Well, we should talk. Yeah. So and then I saw you put out this stuff on, and then I said, "Oh yeah, this guy's interested in carnivore diet," but. Yeah. I think the intersection that we have, Sean, and maybe there's other areas we may want to do research or whatever. But I've worked with a lot of my friends who are, you know, orthopedic surgeons, et cetera. But my interest in all this came from a different journey. You know, I grew up in India, and my grandmother was a traditional healer. You know, there's this entire system of medicine, which is not about acute care, right? Which is about understanding the body as a system. And now they use a completely different language, which you may have heard of. It's in the, it's in Tamil. It's been around for probably 10, 15,000 years. And my grandmother was a village healer. Many of those villages, doctors don't go into them, right? In fact, my uncle, who became a gastroenterologist, he left the village. People never want to come back, right? Because these are small villages, no money to be made there. So typically the women have sort of these traditional knowledge bases, and they sort of, quote unquote, practice medicine, you see? So I saw her empirically heal a lot of people who died. So I was fascinated by this. And then I think I may have shared, I grew up politically also in a world that was a caste system. Mm-hmm. So as a kid, I saw people of the upper caste, which is the small minority of people called Brahmins, which is sort of where Kamala Harris comes from, spit on other people. So as a kid, I was deeply upset mm-hmm. by this. We were the lower caste. So I got intertwined as a kid in two worlds, medicine, this deep love of how this my grandmother was able to heal people empirically, and politics, and that never changed. So when I came to the United States when I was seven, I worked very hard because I knew India was very different. So I thought it was a godsend to be here. And so when I was 14, I started working full time, believe it or not, at a medical college, because I had gone to NYU. I was one of these guys who was an overachiever, was still played sports. But at NYU, we were using computers and biology. It was just coming nascency, Sean, to look at why babies were dying in their sleep. What you would call like pattern analysis, right? Working with surgeons, working with all different kinds of interesting people. And that's where I created this email system. So I got interested in systems, but medicine. When I came to MIT, I was actually on the pre-med route. But something in me got really pissed off, man, that I didn't see medicine really. It seemed like medicine was a phenomenal field for crisis care. And in fact, surgeons were really the ones really doing that, right? Guys like you, neurosurgeons, like you guys were the real practitioners of Western medicine, right? If something god awful happened to you in an accident, obviously taking turmeric ain't gonna help you, right? You need the best care or diet, right? So I went in and out of MIT, did a bunch of degrees in engineering, always trying to want to be in medicine. And then in 2003, I was walking back to MIT. And my advisor, Forbes Dewey, who was, you know, very good athlete, and he was in mechanical engineering. He had three professorships. He said, Shiva, you should come back and finish your PhD. There's this new field called systems biology. And you may know, this is around 2003. Genome Project had just ended, and we find out we have the same number of genes as a worm. So people start realizing that you can't just look for genes as a cause of disease. You have to start looking at the levels of interactions across molecules, proteins, et cetera. That is much more, it's the pathways that make us different from other organisms. So I came back, I was running a company that was doing analysis of emails, you know, came back, and the goal was, could you mathematically model the whole human cell? That was a goal. And if you could do that, you could do very complex analysis. And so that's why I wanted to, you know, you put this out there, you said whether grass-fed or grain-fed, you said it doesn't make much difference. And there's some interesting questions around that. It probably doesn't. It may be the glyphosate more than anything else. But before I go to that, so just to give you sort of the background. So in 2003, the goal is, could you mathematically model the whole cell, Sean? Could you look at all the molecular pathways? Because if you could do that, you could start getting a handle on what's going on at the systems level. So the idea was, could you take maps like these and create large scale quantitative models? So that's what I ended up building. I built this whole technology called Cytosolve. And this was a way, it took me about 5 years in the PhD work. And then I did all sorts of papers and proving its viability. So for example, we took, you may know this in the brain, there are these things called the endothelial, right? Vasculature. And there's a growing evidence that the breakdown of blood-brain barrier is what causes all these neurovascular diseases. So we ended up literally looking at every paper written, Sean, you know, gluing together the large scale molecular maps and then math and creating for the first time an architecture. So when you talk about Western medicine, literally tries to create all these different diseases. you know, and they label them. But in my view, all of these quote unquote diseases are really dysfunctions in particular pathways. And we mapped all these out for every neurovascular disease. When we submitted this to Nature Neuroscience, they thought it was crazy. One half of the reviewers and the other thought it was brilliant. Anyway, we got it published. But what it did was developed a whole systems way of looking at quote unquote diseases and looking at pathways. And to me, this becomes fascinating because you can start modeling this and you can start looking at how foods affect things, you know? And I can keep going on about this. So when I was looking at this question sort of you had put out there, maybe it is the same, right? We know that there's differences in some of these foods. And there's an interesting question. Maybe the foods don't even matter because beef, we're also eating grains, right? There, I mean, all of these are grasses. But it could be the glyphosate, right? It could be pesticides in the feed. So I wanted to just share that because we have this capability to actually answer questions like these. So on the one hand, you're getting a lot of clinical data, right?
Yeah.
Dealing with things that I'm very interested in at the molecular level, validating these things. And we now have a framework to do that. So Cytosol now, you know, since it's, you know, I think we've published about 20, 30 major papers in the largest journals validating it, but it's become an instrument, particularly in the area of food sciences. So we can look at different kinds of food. So we did this in agriculture. We looked at all the, you know, quote unquote soy, and not quote unquote soy, 99% of the soy is freaking genetically engineered. And we showed that genetically engineered soy has 300% less glutathione levels. And we had to do that on a series of six papers. And then Monsanto attacked our work. It was an interesting thing, but I can share that with you later on. But I'm very interested in validating the findings that people are knowing from, you know, like what my grandmother did. We have the ways to validate them right now. So we're actually, for example, we modeled all the molecular pathways of joint health. We looked at every paper, worked with a bunch of orthopedic surgeons. We published that, and then we went through all the potential nutrients in nature, and we found combinations that actually can lower inflammation, lower, you know, all the arachidonic acid pathways. So when you talked about this woman with the knee pain, we can actually show that, you know, at the molecular systems level. And that's what gets interesting for me, because we know there's stuff here. And then over here, you have the traditional or the conventional medical community, which can't accept it overnight. But if we can show the molecular mechanistic reasons, it's much easier for them to absorb. And then you can sort of, you know, advance things faster rather than arguing with these people. It's a faster way to convince them unequivocally.
I guess the question I would have, you know, yeah. I kind of have at least a surface understanding of what you're talking about here. So, you know, you have a model, you know, it's got thousands and thousands of enzymatic pathways. It's, you know, heretofore it was considered a black box, basically input, output, you know, that's what we know, what goes in, what goes out. But I mean, there's also multiple inputs. I mean, when I'm eating a diet, I mean, I'm probably exposed to, gosh, thousands perhaps of nutrients and other inputs. So how do you account for all that? Now, again, obviously you're on an elimination diet and eat the same damn thing every day. You can define that pretty easily. But then once you start getting into the hundreds of inputs, then you get all these, it becomes more complex, obviously. I mean, maybe AI can help solve some of those issues. But
yeah,
what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I'll give you an example here. So if you look at joint health, right? What we did was we looked at the knee, actually, and this was about a 3-year project. We went through 115,000 papers, Sean. We went through every paper and we extracted out every molecular mechanism involved. Okay. And by the way, we open source this. We did it with the University Health Network of Toronto, three leading orthopedic surgeons there, plus people in the field. So I'll send you a link to that. But broadly, it's a very complex system. But so joint health is not only any one thing, right? They have all these supplements, but none of them work because joint health is many things, right? All of these mechanisms are involved, many, many different subsystems. So our technology can map out all of these pathways. And then we can also start understanding what are the key biomarkers in each one of those pathways, right? So if you wanted really good joint health, it's not just, you know, taking collagen, right? Or eating chondroitin, you have to be able to manage all these are. And giving you an example, like seven different outputs here, right? PG2, CGRP levels, COX2, ROS, MMPP13, collagen 2. And there's many inputs that can manipulate that. So we have the ability to scale to n number of inputs. Because what we've done is we've done a mechanistic model, not the problem with AI is only good as the training data, Sean. Mm-hmm. It's not as good as understanding laws. So this actually goes at mechanisms. So for example, we're able to then look at, if you take particular, you have all these inputs, we're actually able to heat map out how particular combinations affect particular mechanisms. So when someone says, oh, I have a, you know, eat this for joint health. Well, you have to look at which pathways are you affecting. So this actually quantitatively calculates. So we, several years ago, we used the work we did with UHN, and then we looked at, for example, natural products, which have, you know, thousands of different compounds, ran it through, and we were able to figure out two particular compounds, which had, at the right dosages, had phenomenal effect on four major pathways. So, and then what we do, Sean, is we publish them in peer-reviewed journals, and then to the extent that we can actually get approvals for them, either at a, with, you know, from FDA, if they want to approve it, right? Or through actual peer review, then we take it out to market if we want, or we license them. That's the large model. But more importantly, the technology is we can handle infinite number of inputs.
So how do you do it? Because there's obviously noxious inputs as well. I mean, you're talking about what, how can we supplement to run this pathway certain, but obviously a lot of that is basically the wrong things are coming in, you know?
Exactly. So you have to model both. Right. So you have the pathways of efficacy. So, I mean, so we, for example, just finished, when we did the joint health pathways, I mean, it came down to probably, if you look at about 100,000 different reactions, each reaction has a rate constant, right? And all of this stuff can also be changing in time as new data is coming. But what we're doing, Sean, we're taking these quote unquote diseases and we're mapping them out. We're taking more of an engineering approach. We're creating the architectures of that disease. So like the knee, what are all the components? So you get a whole systems architecture. Are we nailing it perfectly? No way, because there's still more research needing to be done. But we've created a framework that as new data comes, it's like you're finding individual parts and you're able to plug it in. So we're taking a reverse engineering approach. Once we have these, we can quantitatively model them and then we can look at the inputs. But it directionally gives us an idea, right? So it would be fascinating, for example, to take knee pain. We could put someone on a all vegetarian diet and put them on a carnivore diet. And we can see what's being upregulated, what's being downregulated, and look at, for example, those seven biomarkers of inflammation, let's say. And actually quantitatively do that. And then we're able to get them published. It's taken us around 16 years now to very quietly go into every different field. So we published in periodontal disease, but we take the same approach. We just published a major paper in ALS, right? Or so we're disease agnostic. And the idea is we'll typically find a leader in the field, like we just did one in leukemia. We'll find a leader who's a domain expert and we'll say, look, let's work on this together. So these projects take 3 to 5 years, but in joint health, we have it done. So I thought, this knee thing is fascinating because I tried, you know, sort of the vegan diet very briefly. I grew up eating meat. And then I noticed that I was out in Yosemite one day and I saw a buffalo and I just wanted to eat the thing. Like something deep within me said, fucking kill this thing, you know? But even in India, you know, Hindus actually ate meat. Even Brahmins did. Yeah. Somewhere along the way, they screwed it up. They, you know, because there was animal sacrifices after Buddha came and everyone, a set of people said, don't eat meat, but we're non-Brahmins. We love eating meat, right? But even Brahmins ate meat. So somewhere along the way, I think that was done for sort of some very illogical reasons. But I think it would be fascinating to use cytosol. We could look at knee pain, and we have all the biomarkers now. And you can infuse it with what you consider a meat diet. And, you know, like you did, you know, for the, and then look at it, what it means if you do a vegan diet or whatever people are talking, phytochemical diet. Mm-hmm. And then look at the differences and then map it to clinical studies. But we would know the mechanistic reasons why.
So that's that's fascinating. And I certainly would encourage that to be done. I think because I do think, and you know, just again, I've just got a lot of clinical anecdotal experience of now to the point of thousands of people that, I mean, their joint pain will not 100% of the time, but very often a significant majority of the time improves significantly or completely in many cases, which clearly there's, you know, because there's an, you know, if I'm shooting holes in the wall, I got to go and patch those. But if I stop shooting holes in the wall, it's, you don't need as much stuff to patch it up with. And so that's where the supplementation versus just stop poisoning yourself, you know, kind of comparison goes. And so I'm obviously a big fan of eliminating stuff that's causing this detrimental. And then, you know, there's other inputs outside of food, obviously. There's exercise and sleep and all those things that kind of have an impact here. But yeah, that sounds fascinating. There was a study, University of Alabama did do a study on osteoarthritic pain in the knee, and they looked at a low-carb versus a high-carb, low-fat diet. They found a low-carb diet was significantly more efficacious for, you know, just like you described it. I don't think they were looking at the mechanistic markers that you might be looking at, but I know that's been done at least in a very simple way.
Yeah, to me, the mechanisms of action give us sort of more fundamental laws, you see, that we can leverage. It gives sort of the base theory. So we don't have to keep defending, you know, ourselves over and over and over again, because it says these are the mechanistic reasons. So what's, you know, before this call, and you probably have seen this, I think the whole grass-fed, non-grass-fed, right, grain diet is an interesting question. And it may have, and I just started seeing some papers on this, but when I did a quick review, and by the way, this is no means extensive, right? Obviously, omega-3-to-6 ratio is higher. And these are some things that people have measured, right? From omega-3-to-6, CLA, minerals, beta carotene, vitamin B6. The issue is how much in science, right? And these are some of those values that have been calculated. And same here, these are different things. But to me, it'd be interesting if you consider these. One is just looking at meat versus a vegan diet and understand the mechanistic differences, let's say associated with, let's say, knee pain. And then the next thing would be to look at between these two things, right? And we have the capability to do that, Sean. That's what would be interesting. Years ago, we applied this technology, I'll just show you very quickly. Anecdotally, people had found in the Midwest that people who had, farmers were finding high levels of formaldehyde in GMO-fed or GMO grains. So we did it, this is a completely different area, but we literally, just to give you that, we published our first paper. We understood the pathways of C1 metabolism in plants. And then we modeled that. We showed that glutathione levels stay normal in normal plants, right? And then formaldehyde is detoxified, because these pathways in plants, formaldehyde is detoxified normally, even though it's created. So that was the first two set of papers. The next set of papers we did was what happens when a plant undergoes stress. Oxidative stress. Well, it produces reactive oxygen species. Glutathione levels go down. Formaldehyde goes up. Did different sensitivity. Then we said, what happens when GMOs are introduced? When you genetically engineer soy. Well, it turns out the non-GMO soy formaldehyde can't be as well detoxified, and so formaldehyde levels go up. Glutathione levels go down. Now, when we published this, we got reamed by a bunch of the Monsanto guys. They said, oh, this is just a model. Prove it to us. Well, we were very fortunate. A group out in Leeds had actually done greenhouse studies. So you can see in vivo, they'd seen that transgenic soy has nearly 300% less glutathione. And our analysis was pretty close. This is in silico in vivo. So we do studies like this all day long, Sean, where we can literally look at the empirical data, right, clinical data, and then look at the mechanism, and then understand the mechanisms. And I think this would really help food sciences, particularly this whole issue of carnivore diet, and then getting down to what. And some of the data shows it could be the glyphosate. It has nothing to do with grain or grass, that you do need fat. Animals ate grasses, which had grain in them, like oats and all these things anyway. So I was curious to get your thoughts on that. I know you had said that it doesn't really make much of a difference.
Well, I mean, so I will tell you, you know, just again, this is anecdotal observation. I surveyed 12,000 people at one time just to ask, you know, clinical outcomes. Yeah. I couldn't see a big difference in the clinical outcomes. When Harvard published on this back in 2021, David Ludwig's group asked the same question, grain-fed, grass-finished. Again, no clinical differences. Now, again, could we have measured for biomarkers and found some difference? I think we could have, for sure. And there's no doubt that there, as you mentioned, there are clear nutritional differences on depending on the breed of the cow, the age of the cow, the sex of the cow, the location of the cow, how it's finished, all those things are going to impact that. The question is it clinically significant? And there's not a lot of, there's very little data. There's precious few data, the studies that have been done on actual humans eating grain and grass finished beef. It just, there's Texas A&M did a couple studies around 2010, showed no significant difference. There's a study in Australia where they compared, for some reason, grass finished or grain finished cows to kangaroos, which is not even the same species. So I'm surprised they published that, but they, you know, yeah, they seem to say that there are some differences with that. So, you know, again, to me, it's nice, you know, it's interesting. And there's a guy named Stefan Van Vliet and Fred Provenza at Duke and at Utah State that are doing this work showing the differences that are in the meat itself. But again, does it have a meaningful clinical effect? And that's where I'm like, I'm not sure because I haven't seen it yet. And so I would, you know, if this can somehow, I'm just trying to think how, because you got to validate everything you, I would assume you have to do a clinical validation on every model you propose. Otherwise, like you said,
what's interesting, Sean, is what we're doing is not a model per se, right? Okay. Because a model would be you build something bottoms up. What we are doing in some ways is more systems integration. What's happened is, in medicine, as you know, the incentive, getting back to what you were saying earlier, the incentive in scientific research is to be in your, particularly in biology, be in your silo. You find that protein structure of a molecule, you win a Nobel Prize, right? So it's very, very narrowly focused. So there could be, someone discovers some chemical reaction here, publishes it after 50 years, they're gone to their next project. So what we're doing, Sean, is like sodium plus chloride equals sodium chloride. That's a law in some ways, right? That's a scientific truth. So when we take a disease, like I showed you with that neurovascular disease, we're looking at all these pieces and then we're saying, what does the overall architecture look like? Right. So we're almost reverse. It's like we're coming across an alien ship and we're seeing parts and we're trying to figure out what is this? So to do that, we start bottoms up, which is what engineers do. We create an architecture. So first thing we're doing is we're creating architectures of these so-called phenomena like osteoarthritis. So we have an architecture. First, that architecture has parts in it. Some of the parts exist, some of them we don't know yet. So we have to go to a, you know, sort of a zoomed out level. Those individual parts are chemical reactions, which has in vitro and in vivo studies behind it. And so we validate those. So it's not like we're making a reaction up. We didn't make up sodium plus chloride equals sodium chloride. It exists. So we're finding those pieces, putting them into this architecture, and then we compute them using basic physical chemistry, you know, AP chemistry that we took in high school, but in a mass scale. And then we're resolving all the mass balance equations. That's what cytosol does. So the AI crap doesn't really work for these kinds of problems. Because AI is basically taking what occurred before and projecting. Most of the AI algorithms have been around since 1960. So they're not really interesting. And I was in that field for 20 years here. We're looking at the individual mechanisms. And every piece of our model can literally be validated by a piece of literature where they did the in vitro in vivo study and we have the conditions. So you see what I'm saying? It's more like we're taking pieces and interconnecting them. And when we interconnect those, we will make a prediction based on different inputs. Obviously, does that input match with reality? Because now it's an aggregate. Mm-hmm. So many times we like to actually look at clinical things where you actually have inputs and outputs and then go try to explain the mechanisms using our model, because now you already have the clinical output. So that's why I like looking at these phenomenon people are observing. Oh, we see formaldehyde in grain, or we see knee pain disappear. Well, how could that happen? Well, we have this model, which is, I really don't even want to call it a model. It's more an integration of the existing data in a mathematical form. Can this model explain? Someone just put out here, you could look at tofu, someone eating soy tofu all day, right? You know, versus let's say eating meat, right? How would that affect inflammation? So, but we can do it mechanistically, Sean, and then it would raise new questions. There are certain areas we won't understand, but we can look at it in a very mechanistic way. This reacts with this to get this, to get this, to get this. And it also causes these other byproducts. But that's how we do it. I didn't want to bore you with it, but...
It's interesting. It's a very interesting conceptually. And I just know how complex, as you know, things are very, very complex.
Massively complex.
I'm trying to resolve that in within a whole body system, because you might figure out one particular cell like the myocyte or the osteocyte.
Yep.
And then you've got a billion other cells that are doing potentially impacted differently, and all of them interact with each other where they are.
It's a system of systems problem.
Yeah.
So you have to be able to handle, that's why systems biology, it really is very close to like, feels like fluid mechanics or gas dynamics, because you're dealing with massive scale. It's a massive, it's a multi, it's spatial differences, temporal differences. You have things occurring at nanoseconds, all the way to things occurring over the years, like a human being's life. Nanosecond reactions to someone who's living 80, 90, 100 years. And then you have things occurring spatially at the organelle level, you know, and across organs. So it's a, to me, it's the most challenging area using computing, because you have to be able to handle, and biological computing is much harder than fluid mechanics or these other fields, because there's so many domains that you're dealing with. There are people who just specialize in membrane research all day. People just specialize in a protein all day. So it's a very complex problem, but we've created an architecture to capture that complexity.
What do you think it most lends itself when it comes to human health? Because obviously some things are more complicated than others. Some things you can measure more easily than it. Like the nervous system can be challenging to measure. I mean, there's things we can't measure in living humans that with at least.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we have found is we're pretty disease agnostic, you know? So we just mapped out all the pathways of, for example, Alzheimer's. And you find out like a lot of the stuff there was completely bullshit, you know, the plaque formation theory, all this stuff, when you actually look at it from a systems approach. So I would say that if you're asking about measurement, right, there are obviously things at nervous system levels, it's hard to measure for under certain cases, you know, but, you know, we just finished a massive project looking at relaxation. How do you relax the body? And those lead to a set of pathways that we can measure reasonably well. So it depends, Sean. It's not organ-based. It's basically within that area, what is the phenomenon you're trying to measure? Like pain, right? There are certain kinds of pain that people, like, you know, pain that people have with periodontal disease or even osteoarthritis. There are people whose bones are decaying and they never even have pain. So we've, you know, some of the surgeons we're working with say, you know, no one will report pain, but their cartilage is decayed. So, you know, some of the phenotypes in these areas are different, right? So it depends in a very specific area. But from our engine capability, we can literally go after anything agnostically based on the amount of research that's there. We've done some rare diseases also, like neuromyelitis optica, these kinds of things. But what's exciting for me is it took me years, because I really had a deep love for food sciences, you know, all these nutrition. But I'm looking forward to really, as you have more and more people proposing diets, being able to model whole diets, which you can measure this diet on some metric, right? Inflammation, right? Performance of some kind. That's why I think part of me, when you were putting some stuff out there, and I was, it's sort of good to know that you actually were a surgeon. So you actually have hands-on stuff. So it's not just theory, you know? A lot of guys propose a lot of stuff out there and they don't have any actual visceral experience with it.
Well, I mean, and that's because we look at the corpus of the evidence, the evidence-based medicine, and a lot of it's quite honestly garbage. I mean, honestly, it's not clinically applicable. It's theoretical. It's changes all the time. And I just look at what are the results. I mean, because that's what, at the end of the day, that's what I get paid to do is produce results, you know, and it's like, what are the actual clinical results that actually matter to people? And that's what's drawn to me, what I'm doing right now. Cause I just see the results over and over and over again. And I can't explain it mechanistically. I've got, you know, I can theorize and sort of think this is probably what's going on, but I don't know, you know, you can't know for sure. And maybe something like this would be more able to explain, you know, some of the phenomenon we're seeing for sure.
Sean, I don't know if you saw this. I don't know where you were in March of 2020, but I put this, someone just posted this. I said, in March of 2020, I said, as an MIT teaching biological engineering who studies and does research nearly every day in the immune system, the coronavirus fear-mongering by the deep state, I said, will go down in history as one of the biggest frauds to manipulate economy, suppress dissent, and push mandated medicine. Yeah. And people said, well, how were you able to say something like that? And what's interesting was I put that out, we had two groups of MDs. The typical family practice medical people, they didn't get it. They thought I was crazy. But surgeons, man, got it. I would say more surgeons, because to me, surgeons are more like engineers. They have to be physically in there and they have to make very strategic decisions, mechanistic decisions, versus a physician who's just looking up in the PDR, if this, then this. And to me, engineering sciences and surgeons, I think, have to deal with more reality than the average bear. So I think that's where the opportunity is. So I was able to put out that tweet because from an engineering standpoint, none of this shit made any sense because the immune system is quite resilient, right? To think that overnight you're going to destroy the immune system didn't make any sense. That there are many, many other, the goal was about boosting the immune system. So I think that's where the opportunity is, that in medicine, I do think the surgical aspect of medicine and people who participate in that are the ones, and with engineering minds, I think we can solve a whole host of problems, but also lend credence to methodologies that we're seeing actually work.
Yeah, I was going to say back to the 20, I shared your skepticism. I was very vocal about some of the stuff I thought was complete nonsense. And I got everything shadow banned and suspended and spent my time with that stuff and kind of got frustrated with that. But yeah, I mean, I would concur that, you know, people that go into surgery often have a different mindset than somebody wants to go back and do a different type of practice. I mean, there's definitely a different type of person that attracts. And yes, you're accountable very quickly. I mean, you know, if you don't do the right thing, you know about it. You know, almost.
That's what I'm saying. I think the accountability is immediate. My uncle was a gastroenterologist and he was an Indian. And many times people try to have him come to the United States. He goes, I don't want to come there because you guys just cut all day long. He goes, everything is a slice. And he said he would sometimes sit with patients and he was a very smart guy. He said he would sit with them for an hour and he'd realize that they had no gut issues. It was all mental. They were under massive stress. And he'd say, I don't need to go in. He goes, you need to do these, this and this and this. But he goes, the United States system was all about cutting, meaning as a surgeon, there's a massive incentive to go in there and do surgery because of the rewards on that. So I think those surgeons who make decisions the right way, in my view, they're taking an engineering approach, that it's a very input-output approach. And that's very different than a physician who just tells people to do this or take drugs and so on. They don't really have any accountability there.
It's kind of like being a longevity guru in a way, because it's like, you're gonna pay me back when I don't.
I saw that thing you said about Brian Johnson. You said he's eating away his body.
Well, I mean, in reality, he is. I mean, that's what effectively happens. I mean, you know, you are. I mean, you're still consuming your own tissue. I mean, it's just. I mean, I look at it, you know, and I kind of made the cheeky comment that it's kind of the opposite of nutrition, because you know you're just basically excreting everything. You don't absorb anything. You absorb very little. You can lose weight doing that. That's great, but it's not the point of nutrition. Nutrition is, you know, essential amino acids, essential fats, vitamins, minerals, and some sort of energy source, and then arguably water. And that's not the most efficient way to do that. That's actually a poor way to do it. Now, relative to our American populace who is just over inundated with nutrition and particularly energy, it's in a step up, but it's by far from an optimal way. And particularly if you're going to pretend you're going to cheat death and live forever, which I always laugh when these people tell me they're going to live to 180 or whatever their claims are. I'm very skeptical. I mean, you know, maybe they'll be able to prove me wrong, but I mean, at this point, I don't see any 120-year-olds walking around vigorous and robust, at least in my, you know, maybe there are some, but I've never seen them. I know when I was a surgeon deployed over in Afghanistan as part of the military. And I remember we had this fella come in there. He looked to be about 65 years old to me, but the Afghan surgeons who were learning, they were kind of working with us and trying to learn us, swore he was 155 years of age. And I said, I kind of doubt that. I don't believe you. I asked them how to prove it. And they said, well, he said he was born when some king was around. Uh-huh. I said, well, if that's your proof, I said, well, I could say I was born when Lincoln was, you know, president. And, you know, so it was kind of that type of stuff. But I mean, yeah, the longevity stuff is hard.
I think a lot of this longevity stuff, you know, you have this ancient Indian tradition where people said they could live for a long time using yoga, meditation. But it also comes down to how you're living, right? What kind of life do you want to live? Now, you could probably take a rat and not feed it anything, and it can live three times longer, but it's probably going to be a really pissed off rat, right? Mm-hmm. So I think the issue is we're modulating many, many things. How do you live? Do you have family? Do you have a joyous life? There's all these other components. And I think to your point, I think a Are you living a vigorous and resilient life for a period of time where you're making contributions? But, you know, you could sit under a tree and meditate all day and eat a piece of grass and not move at all and not do much. And that is, you could say, I lived to 200 years, whatever the age is, right? Is that life or is that something else? You know, this guy, Aubrey de Grey, you know his stuff, right?
Yeah, I haven't heard from him in a while. But I know Aubrey de Grey was a guy that I got to be honest, he looked pretty old for he was like 50 and he looked like he was 70 already. I was like, okay,
right. Maybe. Yeah, he was married to a woman who was like 30 years older, I think.
Yeah.
And to people listening, he was a guy who said that there are seven things that can cure all aging. And in 300 years, we'll solve them and you'll live to 5,000 years. Mm. And that got published in PNAS. And most of those techniques he had would be biological engineering techniques, you know, nanorobots, this, that, organ transplants, et cetera. But I think that's a different kind of longevity, right? It's basically you become a machine or organ grafts. I think what we're talking about is something different, right? Using the existing physical body that you have and how do you live a vigorous life than this?
Yeah, I mean, we can upload our brain. We can upload our consciousness into some machine and live forever, theoretically. But I don't know. Is that what you want? Could be for some people. Some people might do that.
So Sean, in your area, you help people. So are you fully carnivore right now? So you don't eat vegetables, any carbs, nothing at all, right?
I had for lunch today, and it'll probably be basically my only meal today. I had two ribeyes and a New York strip. I'm a big human. I'm 260 pounds. I'm 6'5". I'm an athlete. I'm almost 60, mm-hmm. but you know, I still get after it pretty hard. But I mean, sometimes I'll have some eggs, sometimes I'll have some fish, occasionally I have some dairy products. That's pretty much it. I mean,
your core is a red meat. And then
for sure. Probably in excess of 95% of what I consume is probably some form of red meat, mostly beef, occasionally maybe lamb or something like that. But yeah, it's kind of a ruminant meat. And I know, as you said, from India, I mean, the part where, you know, depending if you're in Southern India, maybe it's cool. In Northern, I know there's different regions where it's kind of verboten, but, it's been something. And I think, again, it comes down in a lot of ways to the fat content, because, you know, if we make an assumption that we had some sort of evolutionary history, and some people would disagree with that, but I think there's at least some evidence that's compelling to me anyway. And, you know, it's like, we know what the technology was available a period of time ago. And at some point we had very limited primitive technology, like a spear. And that's what we had to hunt with. And if that's your technology, where are you going to get your calories from? You're going to get it from a big, slow moving megafaunal animal, which is what we clearly did. I believe that's a lot of red meat. You're not going to be chasing chickens around with a spear, and you're not going to be very successful. It's going to be, you know, you look at the amount of effort you'd have to expend to get the same amount of calories. You take down a big mastodon or an elephant, which we clearly did, you can eat for weeks and a half, months, depending on who you have with you, or if you're trying to get that from fish or, you know, birds or something along those, or even small, more agile, like antelopes and things like that, which we later had to do about 80,000 years ago. It seems like we ran out of the big animals and having to hunt the little ones. And so then we started eating leaner meats, and then we had to introduce more carbohydrate into the diet to make up for the deficit in energy, which is coming from the fat from the larger, fattier animals. So I think that's why I think people have success. I think most people that do this diet, and again, I'll be the first one to say, not everybody needs to do it. It's not the only way to get healthy. I look at it as a therapeutic intervention, first and foremost. It's been extremely successful for things like autoimmune disease, gut issues like Crohn's disease. I mean, we've had just tremendous results with that. But we do see it with, you know, help for mental health disorders and diabetes and skin issues like psoriasis and so on and so forth. But I think that, you know, it's a good starting point, and it just, like I said, if you're not consuming carbohydrates, you got to have fat, and red meat has a reasonable amount of fat in there from my perspective. And I think that's why most people gravitate to it. I think we're just naturally drawn to it. It's naturally satiating. It's kind of primitively and viscerally satiating enough to where you're like, okay, I feel like I've really eaten something. Whereas if you try to eat a lot of lean meat, you're going to be hungry and you're going to be thinking about, give me some ice cream, give me some sugar or something like that a few hours later. And that's where the difference. And that's
now, why, Sean, do you supplement or no?
Outside of electrolytes, no, I don't supplement anything.
Yeah. What's up? Yeah. So basically it's electrolytes and water. But no other, you know, because
no, I don't take vitamin C or vitamin D or any of those
things. Guys, they're taking like hundreds of supplements, right? Vitamin D, vitamin C, you know,
right.
You know,
well, I mean, you know, most of the, I think the whole supplement, and I know this pisses a lot of people off, but I think it's my belief that humans don't need supplements to be healthy. I mean, if we're assuming we're eating, I mean, obviously the environment has changed and there's other things that have added to this. And I think our food supply right now has gotten so abysmal. You know, if you look at the grocery store, most of it is just, I think it's more akin to a recreational drug rather than nutrition. You might need to supplement that. I mean, I can see an argument there, but if you're eating, you know, I think as we are more or less, you know, supposed to, in my view, the supplements become superfluous. And the only reason I take any electrolytes, cause I sweat a lot. I work out a lot. I'm running, sprinting, rowing, you know, jujitsu and that type of stuff. So I sweat a lot. And I feel I have to replace that. You know, I can probably just get away with some salt, but that's what I do.
Yeah, it's interesting because I remember when I first came, here when I was 7, and I was an athlete, soccer and baseball, and my mom made steak one day, mm-hmm. and it was the best thing I ever had in my life. You know, and I think I can still remember this. I was 12 years old, and you know, we in India, South India, people eat a lot of lamb and goat. But man, that steak tasted so good. And I knew that my dad told me when he grew up, his grandfather made sure all the men always had meat. And he thought that's why my family in some ways performed better. I mean, you have to understand this low caste Indian family. My dad comes to the United States, which was sort of different, right? And in India, the upper caste used to say the lower caste were dumb. And it was just, they weren't getting any protein, man. So there were school lunch programs implemented so people could just even get good protein. So it's clear that just from a brain standpoint, you need meat at a fundamental level. And I know it fundamentally has significant effects on neurological effects and brain and resilience and all these things. So I think the issue that some people have is, can you live fully on that? And then my view is that I tend to agree with you that it's the core, and then anything you do outside of that is almost like recreational eating. Mm-hmm. You know,
it's I think, you know, like from a sustainability point, I think, you know, we have it backwards where now we're trying to turn meat into a condiment and we're supposed to live on these leaves, right? Live on the leaves and have a little bit of meat so you don't basically die.
Yeah.
And get completely malnourished. And you're absolutely correct. You know, you look at the stunting rates, even in places, you know, India and Africa where they are basically on a grain-based diet, there's tremendous stunting rates. And, you know, when you introduce, like in Africa, there's studies where they just include an egg in the kid's diet, their cognitive performance dramatically increases. And so, clearly it's a great benefit, particularly for developing children. My gosh, you know, their brain is growing at a very rapid rate over those first couple of years, particularly the first 6 years. It's just, I think it's almost criminal to what we're trying to do. I mean, we see people say the Eat Lancet world diet is supposed to be 500 grams of meat per week per person. And that's like, you know, that's equivalent to nations that end up with all these stunting problems. And so,
what's interesting, Sean, is in many of the traditional cultures, right? So the interesting question I have is, I have great value for meat, right? And obviously good meat, right? Where it's coming from. But I've also seen this other part in ancient traditional cultures, which have a lot more history. One of the things that they had, which wasn't a one or a zero, was how was the food processed? To give you an example. So obviously in most traditional cultures, you know, they never ate grain like vegetarians eat it in the United States. They take grain and they just boil whatever grain and they eat it, right? Or the grains and the legumes were treated like medicines, mm-hmm. and they processed them. So for example, grains were soaked for 3 days, fermented. You threw away all the lectins in the water. Same with beans and nuts. So when my mom came here, she'd watch people make, you know, vegetables. She goes, what are you eating? You know, like it made no sense. So I think part of the equation is I think the Western medicine by and large was reductionist. You try to just silo everything. And that too, in some way, I believe is happening with diets too. Meaning that the processing of food is forgotten in this equation. So you will find that in some of these cultures, they figured out that there was a processing you needed to do if you're doing plant-based stuff. Yeah. And it wasn't straightforward, right? So killing an animal, to your point, was much easier, relatively easier, right? You could eat it, cook it. But if you were going to eat a bean, you would have to process it. In some ways, it was like a pharmaceutical process. You'd soak it, throw away the lectins, add in seaweed, so you bound minerals. And many of these civilizations had this down to a science, which is, so I would say that I think we tend to label these areas like vegetarian, carnivore, but I think you can't forget that they're ultimately, we're a chemical being, it's physical chemistry, and we're trying to maximize the amount of nutrient density to our bodies. And so some of these cultures actually figured out, so I wanted to, you know, put that out there and get your
thoughts. There's a fellow by the name of Bill Schindler, who's an anthropologist, and he goes and lives with all these primitive tribes throughout the world. He talks about the exact same thing, how they ferment dairy, how they deal with certain foods to so that they are, you know, as you probably know, I mean, there's people probably in the lower castes in India working on these cashew things, and their hands rot off of them because it's so toxic with the arachidiol that's in there. So you have all these compounds that you have to figure out how to extract to make them safe to eat. And I think that, you know, like I said, again, depending on what you believe and how far back you go, I mean, you know, once you run out of meat to eat, you got to eat something. You still have to continue to get nourishment. I will still maintain that meat is far more bioavailable. It's an easier strategy. You know, if you think about just from a very basic level, I'm built of a collection of animal cells. I mean, you cut me down to the basic level, I've got cell, you know, I've got cell membranes, I've got these animal cells, and I need ingredients for it. So where's the best place to get those ingredients? Well, get eating more animal cells. When I'm eating a plant, I'm not made out of cell walls. So we have different stuff. So the analogy I like to use is, if I'm going to build a brick house, it's nice to have bricks. I can have straw and mud over here, but it's going to take a lot more effort. And I think that's how the plant-based stuff. It's not that you can't do that, but it's just less efficient. And if we look at all creatures that have ever walked, flown, or swam on the planet Earth, about 70% of them have chosen a carnivorous route just because it is more efficient. It's a more efficient way to do things. And then, you know, to be a strictly herbivorous animal requires a lot of adaptations. It's much more of a complicated digestive system. There's more complicated metabolic pathways that go into that. So meat becomes simpler. And so it's a simple way to consume things. And I think, you know, I think humans are nice in that we have the option in a way. But again, you know, and again, we're living in this modern environment where everybody's sick. Every second person has got some sort of chronic disease, it seems like. That is it. We just can't adapt to our current diet. Our current diet clearly is killing us. And if we were just to roll the clock back 100 years nutritionally, probably 75% of the chronic diseases would go away. I mean, I think that's irrespective of whether it's meat-based or plant-based or whatever it might be.
Yeah, I think one conclusion that comes out of this is there's a lack of understanding of how you eat and what to eat, right, at a very fundamental level. The inputs that people put into their bodies are really driven by consumer advertising and theories that never were really backed up. And I think that we're someone just put gorillas don't eat meat.
Well, that's true, but I'll tell you what they do. They eat 40 to 60 pounds of leaves a day, and they eat their own feces to recycle beets so they can get their B12 in. So, right. I mean, if you want to adopt a gorilla-like diet, go ahead and eat 40 or 50 pounds of leaves every day. That's not efficient, right?
Sean, I think the reality is that we are omnivores. We could probably survive on many things, like eating your own shit and eating dirt and eating maggots and probably a ton of things. I think it comes down also to a practical level of what is the most efficient way to eat, to live a particular kind of life that you want to live, right? So if you want to be a gorilla, that means you're foraging for food, probably for 8 hours, 9 hours a day. So I think that's the other equation. What is the lifestyle you want to live? What gives you an ability to live in the
sport? Well, you know, and that's the thing. I can eat once a day. I mean, literally the time I dedicate to eating and nourishing myself is 20, 30 minutes a day. I mean, that's it. I mean, it's like, okay, now I have the remainder of the 16 hours that I'm awake to do stuff. So I'm not constantly thinking about food, preparing food, buying food, wondering about food, dreaming about food. I'm like, I'm done, and I'm on to something else. So
and I think this is probably one of the most important things, that how much time do you have to spend? When I did a raw food vegan stuff, because I've tried all of this in my 20s, man, I was just fucking spending time all day long trying to figure out what to eat.
Yeah.
Because you're trying to all you were doing eating. Like, what do I have to get? I have to get this. I have to get this. I have to get this. Yeah. Because you're not getting, and you're always on a trap, a sort of high wire. Are you getting enough nutrients? And you never were, or you'd have to consume so much food.
Right.
And you have to take a ton of supplements. So yeah, the issue is nutritional density.
Yeah, it seems like that is not a very particularly good strategy. And, you know, you look at any other animal in the wild and it's not sitting there with a calculator and, you know, they're not struggling. I mean, they eat what's available to them and they, you know, outside of famines and things like that, they generally do pretty well. Whereas, you know, humans and, you know, I think we got some of the scientists involved and I think they effed it up, to be honest. I think that's where we are with that. You know, we've got this issue that, is a real problem, and we have to unwind that because everybody's been kind of, I think, hypnotized and brainwashed and propagandized to now you got to say, hey, like, this shouldn't be that hard. It shouldn't be that hard to figure out how to eat something.
Sean, what do you think about digestive enzymes? Have you noticed that, you know, if you eat tons of meat, that do you think your gut sort of falls into line? Because there's a set of theories that I've read that, yes, meat is good to eat, right? Carnivore diet, but you need to make sure that you also have proper digestive capabilities in your gut.
Right, right. Well, we do know that the gut's digestive capacity ages like the rest of us. And so we often see, like, older folks, for instance, don't produce enough stomach acid.
Yeah.
And that can be a problem. And, you know, and we've also medicated people into you know, poor stomach acid production because they have, you know, have gastroesophageal reflux. Instead of addressing the underlying issue, we just, again, disease manage it with a bunch of proton pump inhibitors. And so, I mean, I think you obviously have to be able to absorb your nutrition. So for some people that makes sense, particularly early on. But what I see is, like, as I see people's inflammation going down, their joints getting better, their overall metabolic health gets better, a lot of times their digestive capacity actually kind of reverts to something that's more healthy. I don't think a healthy human being, a young, healthy human being should ever have to take digestive supplements.
Yeah,
I think we should just be able to eat food. And I think, I mean, that just makes obvious sense. But I think as we get older, we break down, we come diseased. Sometimes we need that little crutch, and a lot of times it's a temporary crutch because I see people that initially for, you know, a month or two or three or four months they might be on these digestive supplements, and then all of a sudden they're like, okay, I don't really need that anymore. So there is some merit for that for some cases.
And Sean, what are you seeing as some of the if you look at what Saladino says, how does your stuff differ with his stuff? Are you guys on the same page?
Yeah. Well, I mean, no, we're not, you know, so he came to me initially when he first started and was asking me all kinds of questions. And he had these, and I said, look, it's very simple. This is all I got to do. And he said, no, that can't be right, because it doesn't make sense. I'm looking at the RDA. I think I need to take all these, you know, organ meat supplements and all this stuff. And
And
he started doing that, and he was practicing, and he was trying to be extremely lean. I think he was under eating. And so he said, well, I'm under eating. So now I don't feel very good. I'm cramping up. So now I'm going to add all this carbohydrate back in there so that I don't do that. So I think he just approached it in the wrong way. I think, you know, cause he didn't listen, because the information I got, you know, I'm not some super, you know, super intellectual person to just figure this out myself. I listen to a bunch of people that are already doing it. They've been doing this for 20, 30 years, 50 years, 70 years, 100 years, and use kind of like that ancient wisdom, like you're talking about with your grandmother. Say, hey, look, these people already figured this stuff out. Why reinvent the wheel? It's working well. But again, the scientist gets in there and says, oh, this doesn't make sense because of everything I know. And, like, you don't really know anything regarding this stuff. So I kind of adopted the let's go on the proven results rather than the theoretical, you know, speculative stuff. And so I think it just ultimately didn't work to him. And so he decided, well, now I have to eat, you know, 400 grams of fruit a day or something like that, fruit and honey and all this stuff. And now rather than, because, you know, initially he was like, well, this stuff is all bad. Now I'm going to justify why it's now good, because this is what I'm having to do myself. So I think it was probably a product of him just underfueling himself, adding all these unnecessary things. I don't think you need to be eating, you know, 4 pounds of liver a week or anything like that. I mean, even if you just look at an animal, I mean, just proportionately, even if you assume you were going to eat the whole thing. And I don't think everybody did. I think, like, a lot of people find that not particularly flavorful. I mean, a lot of people are actually put off by the flavor of kidneys and liver and things like that. They just don't find it tasteful. And I think that humans did not live in a condition of subsistence for most of our existence. I think there were a period of times where we were actually adequately nourished. I think that's how we developed our brain. I don't think we can go from a primate of a 300 cc brain up to a human being of 1500 cc's, which what we peaked out at about 125,000 years ago. on a subsistence diet. I think we had plenty to eat. We're probably knocking off all these megafaunal animals. You know, we had plenty of fat, plenty of meat, and we just ate what we want, and we discarded the parts we didn't want. I mean, we know that, like, for instance, you know, Native Americans would often do buffalo drops, and they would just, you know, they'd take a few, they'd leave hundreds of dead buffalo and just completely ignore it. So I don't think they were focusing necessarily on eating every part and, you know, having to eat, you know, baboon testicles and whatever you can get just to sort of, you know, hit this theoretical magic nutrient blend. I just think it's simpler than that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the key thing is that diet cannot be that complicated. When it gets this complicated and the complexity that it happens, I think it becomes unmanageable for people. And then so I think that a lot of the ancient wisdom, if to the extent that it, a lot of it came from actually practice over thousands of years. I think one of the key takeaways that I found was that they took a systems approach to the body. Even these ancient systems of medicine, Sean, what I uncovered was when I went back to India on Fulbright, that these ancient systems of medicine, they looked at your body. My grandmother would look at your body and she would try to body type you. You know, what were certain functional differences? And then for those functional differences, you got particular nutrients, you know? So there was some concept of some level of personalization for people. So that seemed to exist. And then there was some concept of finding the right level of nutrient density for those people to bring people up to homeostasis. So all these ancient systems of medicine, they understood that your body had a certain homeostasis and people were off. And the idea was to just bring it back on course and the body sort of self-healed. That was sort of this fundamental concept. And most of the problems were nutritional deficiencies, that people didn't have enough of certain things. So I think that was a broad things that I understood. And so I think things have become very, very complicated. And when things become complicated, even the wellness industrial complex starts becoming as bad as the big pharma complex in some extent, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it's obviously multi-billion dollar, tens of billions of dollars going to that for sure. One thing, you know, I will, you know, one, I would say that, you know, since the adoption of agriculture, it's changed dramatically how, you know, we interact with, you know, it's, it could arguably be a net detriment to our, at least individual health. It's been helpful on a societal level because we could be stay in one place and form civilizations and collective, you know, our knowledge collectively could come together and we could solve these great problems. But on an individual level, you could argue it's been a disaster. But another thing on the processing, you know, because if you think about it, you know, irrespective of what you believe, if we were omnivorous, and I certainly would, I would, you know, agree that we're omnivorous. If I'm going out hunting or gathering, I'm not going to come back with any kind of powder. I'm not going to get powdered sugar. I'm not going to get powdered flour. It's just literally impossible. And that has a very different absorption profile in our gut. And, you know, it's we've just kind of changed what we're exposed to. Whereas in the past, you know, even if I were to eat some, you know, tuber off the ground or a piece of fruit, it's not powder. That you know, the absorption, the surface area just completely changes. Even protein powder for that matter. It's completely changed on how we are supposed to handle things, how our gut works, and it interacts with our microbiome, which is another very complex system, as I'm sure you know. So we the processing does play a role, like I said. And initially, you know, processing meat is like kill the animal, skin the animal, cut it up, throw it in a fire, and you're done. Whereas if you're trying to, you know, detox cassava or cashew nuts or grains, you've got to go through these soaking and sprouting and detoxification. Yeah. And it's much more complicated. And now we have machines that do it for us. And now we can turn things into powders and turn it into cake batter and we can bake a cake and, you know, we can enjoy that. But at the same time, it's not what we're designed for.
Yeah. And I think that's sort of maybe the takeaway for people listening here, that there are probably infinite kinds of things we could eat. That's one axis. The issue is what is appropriate for us and then what actually makes sense from a density standpoint, or how much time you're going to spend eating. The other thing I wanted to end with, I know you got to get going, you have about an hour, is that you made an interesting point that there was probably a lot of food at one point. And what's interesting is when you look at CO2 levels, I have a big problem with the entire climate change scam. Mm-hmm. Because CO2 is not an enemy. It turns out that when humans really grew, the volume of us grew was when there was a lot of CO2, which is when a lot of these herbivorous animals came to be, right? So we actually prosper well in a high CO2 environment. In fact, CO2 levels are the lowest. So when I looked at that area, Sean, I found out the whole thing's a fucking scam. The entire concept of carbon, CO2, climate change, climate has always changed. CO2 levels are the lowest that they've ever been. Human beings would not even have made it this far if we didn't have high CO2 levels. And all the mathematical models, there's 140 different models for predicting CO2 levels and temperature. And every one of them predicts there's going to be all the ice is going to melt in the Arctic, and the other predicts nothing's going to melt, and every flavor in between. And so, you know, when I decided to run for president, I realized that when you look at what's out there, you have a bunch of idiots running. If you look at 2020, all of these people promoted lockdowns, including, I call him Booby Effing Kennedy. He's all over the map. He's supposedly doing MAHA suddenly, right? He was promoting vaccinate everyone. He was promoting lockdowns. So was Trump. So was Harris. So was Jill Stein, you know? And all of them support the climate change scam. So
they're all scared. I mean, they all got scared. They listened to the propaganda and got scared, and they don't know what to do because they're not experts in this.
Right, field. Exactly. That's what I'm trying to say. Right. But when the shit mattered in 2020, how can you trust these people? So these people are opportunists. They don't say what needs to be said at the right time because they do not know science. They haven't been engineers. They haven't ever had to get in there and solve a problem. And I think this is where we're headed to. We live in a world of complex systems. And the leaders we need are people who can actually understand complexity and can make very prudent decisions and give direction at the right time, not when it a year later. So to me, 2020 was a critical point. It separated those people who could see the future and those people who scam people. But the climate change stuff is where a lot of this stuff comes from. Don't eat meat, right?
Oh, sure.
And all of this stuff is based on bullshit science. There's a professor at MIT who I became very good friends with, Dick Lindzen. He was the only MIT professor who said, get out of the Paris Accords. 140 other academics destroyed him. I did a video, you'll find out, exposing the climate change scam. So we live in this world that you literally have people, a lot of people on the internet right now, grifters. They 5 years later, they'll talk about stuff as though they were experts. But when the shit is hitting the fan, these people are either silent or they misdirect people. And those 1 or 2 years could make a massive difference, right? All the pandemic lockdowns, $16 trillion, 600 billionaires made $2.3 trillion. So I think the discussion we're having, I want to just frame it that there is actual experience, you know, and then you can back it up with mechanistic understanding. But a lot of these fucking guys, man, they just make up stuff as they go, or they don't say the right things at the right time. So that's why I decided to run. And what's happened, Sean, just to give you an insight, Washington is one of the states we got on the ballot and they didn't throw us off. In New Jersey, we got on the ballot or they threw us off on this natural born issue, right? Which we're challenging, which we say violates equal protection. And it was Kamala Harris's people threw me off in New Jersey. That's going up to the US Supreme Court. But in Wisconsin, Trump's people threw us off. So this election is supposedly so close, 48%, you know? And what we're telling people, it's no longer about Tweedledee and Tweedledum. We're building a larger movement that's on truth, freedom, and health, and finding people, highly intelligent people, not from educational backgrounds, but just gut-wise smart and have intuitive experience with things. So when you talked about Paul Saladino, it's not coming from intuition. It's coming from sort of a fear and a wavering, right? Because there's a lack of understanding of certain principles. So I think this principle-based understanding from a systems approach is what's really going to change the world, not little pieces of knowledge, because little pieces of knowledge disconnected takes you into 50 different ways. So,
well, like I said, I wish you luck with that, because, you know, if you're swimming, you know, you look at everybody just kind of follows along, and this, you know, we make the jokes about the sheep just following along, and obviously the media has got a lot of conflicts of interest. It kind of just further this, agenda, whatever it might be. And, you know, I've been, you know, my friend, the guy named Saifedean Ammous, who's sort of a Bitcoin guy. I don't know what your thoughts are around Bitcoin, but he jokingly talks about, you know, cow farts boiling the oceans, is, you know, saying how preposterous it sounds. And I of course was like, of course it doesn't make sense. You know, we did have megafaunal animals in huge, enormous numbers.
Yeah.
through the entirety of the Homo sapien experience and the human experience, which predates that by another, 2.5 million years. And it's like, that's right. We had lots of lush tropical, greenery, which, in many ways is probably better for us. I mean, you can make that argument for sure.
What's interesting, Sean, is do you know all of these climate change models that they did? Because what they're doing is they have a bunch of inputs. They're trying to model two turbulent fluids, the ocean and the atmosphere. Do you know that, the biggest thing that they left out of their models? Clouds.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
So clouds are like the iris of the eye. That's what Lindzen showed, that, I shine a bright light, your iris closes. And it turns out that clouds, I forget what several billion years ago, the sun's temperature, which today is measured to be around 6,000 Kelvin, was 30% less. So you would think, wow, the sun is much 30% less. You'd think everything would be frozen. Turns out there was lush waters and waterfalls and everything. It's the clouds. The clouds know how to, it's an intelligent system. The clouds know how to maintain homeostasis. So again, you have scientists who don't take a systems approach. They don't see things as large scale systems, which develop their own emergent properties of homeostasis and control. They look at pieces, like the blind man looking at the, who touches the elephant. So this is the unfortunate state that we're in, even in academic science. Now, looking at reductionism is very valuable when you're trying to understand parts. But when you try to understand large scale systems, it just falls apart and people come up with conclusions that make no sense.
Yeah. Well, I just wonder, because you've got to zoom out. I mean, this is the human body, for instance. I mean, we can dice it up into various specialties, which is what we do in medicine. We've got a left eye surgeon and a right eye surgeon. I'm being a little facetious, but I mean, essentially that's what we end up with. And the earth, the earth, the solar system, whatever we want to, that takes a long way to come out of there. I mean, to expand out there to figure all that out and say, okay, this is how this system works, it's got to be a challenge. I mean, it's got to be just tremendous challenge. Cause you think about it, there's a guy who's an expert on cumulonimbus clouds. There's probably a world expert on that particular tiny part.
Exactly.
And then you're like, okay, now we're going to expand it out to encompass everything. So it seems like almost you need some sort of omniscience to figure that out.
That's why I think the field that developed 1920s is really the field that's really should permeate. It's called engineering system science, which says you have to take, we live in complex systems and there's a different language that you need to understand large scale systems. And that is really where things need to head towards. And what's interesting is what I've discovered, Sean, that engineering systems principles matched one-to-one with traditional systems of medicine, the principles that they used. So these ancient rishis and yogis came to realize the body is a very complex system. You can't look at it as molecules or cells. You have to develop a different language, a meta language. And that's what they did. And so engineering systems approach is what gives us a way to look at large scale systems. And we can do a longer conversation about that. But I think that's the knowledge that needs to be provided. It gives a very different lens to look at, something like this, the complex human body. It's not just the nose or the ear or the lungs. It's a much larger emergent property.
Yeah. So yeah, I don't disagree. Well, unfortunately I do have to go for another meeting, but Dr. Shiva, I appreciate
the Sean, do you want to let people know? Yeah. I think you, Sean, do you still do research stuff or do you still do orthopedic work or your full-time?
So basically our company is going to be publishing data around clinical outcomes and just as importantly, financial data, because we want to show that we can save money by what we're doing. So we're doing that. I'm in the background. I'm not a researcher myself. I'm sort of putting researchers with funding sources to try to get some of the research that I think needs to be done around some of this stuff. So I do have my toes in the water on that in a little way. This has been fascinating. I'd love to continue it another
day. Let's do a follow-up, because if you want to frame like carnivore diet versus vegan diet and show mechanistically, we have some tools to do that.
That'd be fun. So for sure
we should do a follow-up on that. All right, Sean, thanks. Safe travels. I know you're headed out to
all conference. Right, thank you very much.
Be well, man. Take care. Bye-bye. All right, everyone, that was Sean Baker, who's an MD who is essentially a practicing carnivorian. And so I wanted to have this conversation with him, but I hope this is valuable to all of you, that you realize that ultimately choosing what diet is right for you is a complex systems problem, right? Someone was putting up here, you know, why not, you know, gorillas, you know, don't eat meat. Well, the reality is we are omnivores. You could probably survive on any number of things. And that's what I hope came out of this discussion. We're a complex system, and a human being could probably survive on any number of things. The issue is, given your body type, given what's going on in the environment, and given where you want to go, what's the right diet that's optimal for you? You see, in this discussion, people don't want to have in the world of diet, because it can lead to, you have infinite choices. So what we discussed was, if you want a lot of nutritional density, you don't want to be worrying about eating all day, you don't want to be taking tons of supplements, the optimal thing may be to eat a carnivore diet. And obviously, then you have to balance that with getting enough electrolytes. If for whatever reason, religious reasons, you don't like eating meat, there's other things you can do, right? Eating a vegetarian diet. But even that, you have to do it the right way. To all of you out there, you know, every other Fridays, we do an entire course or tutorial called Systems Health. We help people figure out what kind of body type you are, what's the right diet for you, what's the right lifestyle, and it's infinite choices. And we are now training systems health educators globally to help other people figure out what's right for them. And we've created an engineering framework that helps people do that. So I hope you guys understand there's infinite, infinite possibilities for health and well-being. So don't think there's only one way. It's infinite possibilities. And it's complex, but once you understand this framework, it actually becomes quite simple to figure out what's right for you. So maybe what I'll do is I'll play a video for you, which is my journey, which I don't think we played in the beginning, that'll give you sort of how I came across this approach. And I call it Journey to Systems. I think here is here. So I'll play this video, and then I'll come back, give you guys a couple of URLs that you may want to go. But if you go to systemshealth.com, Trey, if you can produce systemshealth.com/tutorial, okay? I think that site is up there. Please sign up to come to one of our tutorials. It's free. Every other Fridays we do it. But we'll open you guys up to understanding there's a systems approach to understanding the body. I'll be right back, but understand that there's infinite possibilities. So when people say, I'm going to eat this diet, I'm going to eat that diet, I'm going to do this diet, the reality is there's infinite possibilities. The issue is figuring out what's right for you. So I'll be right back.
Welcome to VA Shiva. VA Shiva is a product of my journey across East and West, science and tradition, ancient and modern, that brings you the science of systems so you can become a force for truth, freedom, health. VA Shiva is a platform of revolutionary education, community building, and weaponry for unleashing local activism. My journey to VA Shiva begins in the chaos of Bombay, where I experienced diverse religions, languages, castes, and in a small village that had no running water, no electricity, where my grandmother, a poor village farmer, practiced Siddha, an ancient system of Indian medicine over 10,000 years old. She observed one's face, the art of Samudrika Lakshanam, to understand a body's unique constitution, allowing her to deliver the right medicine for the right person at the right time. Watching my grandmother heal others, I was inspired to study medicine, but I was also aware of the corrupt caste system of India, which denigrated a human being, where my family were considered low caste untouchables, where one's birth determined one's destiny. The grit and determination of my mother and father led them to get educated and to come to America, a one in a trillion event. Their actions inspired me to work hard and excel. While in ninth grade, I attended New York University in a computer science program, and subsequently, at the age of 14, was given a full-time job as a research fellow at what is now known as Rutgers Medical School in the heart of Newark, New Jersey. There, I investigated the system of sleep using mathematics, computer science, and biology for sudden infant death syndrome. It was there in Newark where I invented email when I was the first to convert every feature of the physical, paper-based inner office mail system, including inbox, outbox, memo, carbon copy, blind carbon copy, attachments, into its electronic equivalent, a system which I named email, a term that I was the first to coin. On August 30th, 1982, I was awarded the first U.S. copyright for the invention of this system, recognizing me as the inventor of email. At that time, copyright was the only way to protect software inventions. I went on to MIT, where I earned 4 degrees across multiple systems of engineering: electrical, mechanical, design, biological. That training led me to invent many other systems for advancing humankind. Echomail, the world's first intelligent email management system. Cytosolve, a computational biology system for eliminating animal testing to discover new medicines faster, cheaper, and safer. And to the creation of a whole systems methodology for certifying clean food. These innovations led me back on a Fulbright to India, where I discovered the missing link between Eastern medicine and Western systems theory, honoring my grandmother, to develop Your Body, Your System, a powerful tool that will help you understand how your body is a system and how the inputs of food, supplements, and exercise bring your body back to its natural system state. And Systems Health, an integrative educational discipline that is now integrated into the VA Shiva platform that will enable you to learn the science of systems, the science of everything, be it your body as a system or our society and politics as a system, to reveal the foundational interrelationships between truth, freedom, health. Now is the time for you to be the light, learn the science of systems, build community, and weaponize yourself to unleash the activism necessary to deliver truth, freedom, health in your local community. Welcome to VA Shiva.
All right, everyone, come to the Systems Health tutorial, which we'll be having. But my aim for all of you is to understand that there's a systems approach to everything that takes place in the world, and people use the word systems, but very few people even know what that word means. And my mission and the movement that we've created for Truth, Freedom, Health is to educate as many people to understand principles of systems. Those in power understand system science, and you can use this powerful knowledge to advance your body, to advance your society in many, many infinite ways for greater truth, freedom, and health, or you can use it to suppress people. And so I used to teach system science at MIT, and I recognize that the vast majority of people, the 8 billion of us, don't have access to that knowledge. So I felt that I could help and advance the world more by bringing that knowledge out to everyone's, like Prometheus bringing the fire. System science is that kind of fire. So recognize that there's, when you understand system science, systems thinking, you really liberate yourself from left and right, pro or anti, this one diet, not that diet. You can argue all day, but the world is a very complex system, but you can understand that complexity from a systems approach. So I want to encourage all of you guys to get involved, become part of wanting to save yourself. But to save yourself, you need tools that help you let you see things as they truly are. So as I close, we're going to play our anthem video. Trey, if you can do that. And I wish you all a good night, and be well. Thanks, Trey.
We have allowed our country to be taken over from within. And the end goal is you will have a homogenized world where we will become slaves, because there is a condition among the elites that really thinks they're better than you, deep down inside them, that you don't deserve the freedoms you have. They don't. This reality is what people need to wake up to, and we need to all unite working people. There's only one movement that can do that, and that is the movement that we started creating here in Massachusetts, the Movement for Truth, Freedom, and Health. Look, I've been a student of politics since I was a four-year-old kid, studying revolutionary movements, left wing, right wing. There's a physics, there's a nuclear science to destroying the establishment. To build a bridge, you need to understand Newton's equation. You need to understand the laws of gravity. You need to understand Poisson's ratio. There is a way to build a revolution. And that's why I put this together. My goal is to train a army of truth, freedom, and health leaders. We don't need followers like social media. We need leaders, but they need training, because the educational system does not teach them history, nothing. So in 3 hours, that's what I've started doing. That's the solution. Wow. We got to train people first with understanding what a system is, the dynamics of all systems that affect nature. The second is understanding the interconnection between truth, freedom, and health. Freedom is the ability to move freely, communicate freely, talk freely. Without freedom, you cannot convert ideas, hypothesis into truth, which is science. And without freedom, you can't really get to truth. And without truth, you make up fake problems and fake solutions, which means you destroy our health. And without health, which is the infrastructure of us and our body, you can't fight for freedom. Truth, freedom, health. Third concept is it has to be bottoms up. Working people, people who work uniting. And what the right wing has done is whenever you say working people unite, that must be communist. Meanwhile, they've let the Democrats run unions, which suppress workers, completely corrupt. But when you look at the arc of American history, it's been when working people came up. We need to go local. Every solution I'm coming up with is a part of this movement. We're giving the science, which is the truth, and then we tell people what they can do on the ground. Like with election fraud, you don't need to wait for some lawyer. Our goal is to train people to go local, to go local, to go local, fight locally. Forget lawyers, forget politicians, forget celebrities. You've got to learn politics, and there is a science to it. They lock us down, we should be ready to shut them down. And the fourth part of this principle is the not so obvious establishment. So when you look at a system, there's always something that disturbs you from getting to your goal. Well, the biggest disturbance is the not so obvious establishment, which are those people who claim they're for you on the left and the right. The Al Sharptons who tell black people I'm for you. The Tucker Carlsons. Do you think any true anti-establishment person will ever be on Fox or CNN? I don't think so. They both mislead working people back into the establishment. Without this solid understanding of political physics and theory, you're screwed. You're going to follow on the left wing Bernie Sanders. Oh, he said something. Or Robert Kennedy. Scumbags. Or you're going to follow some right-wing talk show host. They're not going to lead us to liberation. It's us. We're building a bottoms-up movement. And that political physics, it's a nuclear science of change. Bottoms up. We have to organize to understand that there is people who talk a good game and then look at what they actually do, left and right. I'm sorry, Sean Hannity may say some good things, but I don't see the urgency in his voice to get something done. And it can only come when you weaponize yourself with the right knowledge. You need to be able to identify a rat. You know, Christ didn't go after the Romans, right? It was the Pharisees and the Sadducees who screwed him up. His own, quote unquote, people. And that's where we're at. So these four concepts I've built into a curriculum where people can go to truthfreedomhelp.com, and it's an educational program. We need to train people in political theory. You need to have physics. And I've created that curriculum. People need to get educated. We need to get educated fast. And within a half an hour, I can teach people 2 years of MIT control systems. I teach people those concepts. Then I apply it. Anyone can understand it. And then you say, oh, I got to build a bottoms up movement. They have to get politically astute, and then they have to go locally and act, not sit there on social media. They have to act locally, defy locally, do civil obedience locally, but with knowledge on how to build a movement. Now, the Senate campaign's expanded to the Movement for Truth, Freedom, and Health, and they can find it on truthfreedomhelp.com so people can sign in. They can get access to a bunch of videos. If they want to take a course and become a Truth, Freedom, Health leader, I offer a full scholarship there, but we want people to make a commitment that they'll study, that they'll get certified, that they'll go do activities on the ground. So go to truthfreedomhelp.com.